Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore co-hosting. And teching for us today, as pretty much always, is Lamia. We have a really packed program. I feel like I've been saying this a lot lately.
You do. We start every show with, we're going to have a packed program.
But honestly, it really is. So we're going to start things off by talking about animals in zoos, and we're going to look at it from two different perspectives. We're going to speak with Rob Laidlaw, who is the director at ZooCheck, where he is the director at ZooCheck, and he's also the co-founder of ZooCheck Canada, and he's the WSPA, which is the World Society for the Protection of Animals Projects Manager, and we're going to talk about the physical and psychological effects of confined living for animals who are at zoos, and then we're going to shift our focus a little bit and speak with Pat Tohill, who is the campaigns manager for WSPA, and he's going to be talking about Ontario roadside zoos. This is something that I don't know very much about, but I guess there's quite a few roadside zoos, and Pat argues that the conditions are actually much worse than sort of the mainstream regular zoos in Canada, or at least in Ontario anyway. And then we're going to shift our focus once again, and we're going to be speaking with Lawrence Carter-Long, who is the issues specialist at In Defense of Animals, and he's going to tell us about the World Week for Animals in Laboratories, which is starting on April the 23rd, and he's going to give us a primer on vivisection, so you can find all out about what types of experiments are currently going on in terms of biomedical research and some of the rationales that the scientific community uses, or the vivisection community, I don't even know if it's scientific, they use to justify their tactics or their experiments. And he's going to tell us about the types of activism that he's been doing, I guess sort of anti-vivisection stuff for quite a while now. And then we are going to move to the seas, and we're going to be speaking with Captain Paul Watson, who is the he's the captain of the Farley Mowat, and he's also a founding member of Greenpeace, and he is involved with Sea Shepherd as well. That's sort of, I guess, how he's mostly known at this point. And we are also going to read some listener responses to talk about the Trust in Tofu article that was published through the Globe and Mail. And this was in response to a woman who decided to do the veggie challenge for a week. And she had kind of a rough experience with it. She did some good things, so she had some positive experiences. But overall, I think the vegan community who read that anyway were thinking, oh, you could have tried some silk in your coffee, or why didn't you try some tofu-y ice cream or something, you know, things to make transitioning to veganism a bit easier. So a lot of people wrote in and gave their ideas about if someone was going to try veganism for a week, what advice would you give them? So that's our program.
It is packed.
It's very packed. So we're going to do a little bit of music, and then we're going to come back. No, we got him on the line? All right, we'll go right into it. Thanks for being on the show, Rob.
Thank you.
Tell us about your work with ZooCheck Canada and WSPA in terms of your work with on zoos.
Well, I'm involved in a wide variety of activities. Most of them revolve around creating standards and rules for zoos to operate by. And within those standards and rules, generally, there's a mechanism to close the worst zoos. So I call it, most of what I work on, a system of graduated abolition. You get rid of the worst, raise the bar so that the rest have to improve, and then you look at what's left of the bunch and try to improve that bunch and get rid of the lower end, and you keep going until eventually you have either the cream of the crop or none at all.
So currently right now, how would you describe the conditions for animals in Canadian zoos and specifically Ontario zoos?
Not very good. There are a few relatively decent exhibits in the province, like the Halliburton Wolf Center. But generally speaking, if you went throughout the province, the zoos are in quite dismal shape. There aren't very many bright lights in this province or in this country for that matter.
And how about the regulations, the state regulations, the provincial regulations in terms of making sure welfare standards are met?
Well, there really aren't any in most provinces. There's sort of a patchwork of legislation depending upon what province you're in. Here in Ontario, there's a permit required for the keeping of native wildlife, but there aren't any mandatory conditions attached to that permit. So, you know, people are getting away with an awful lot. If you happen to own non-native species like tigers or ostriches or, you know, chimpanzees, then there are no regulations at all. So it's pretty much anything goes. And in some provinces, it's a little bit better. In some provinces, it's just as bad. So, you know, right across the board in Canada, we really need improvement in the way that animals and particularly zoo operations are governed. It's pretty much anything goes in a lot of areas.
I think a lot of times zoos get positioned as being sort of havens for conservation, and I think that the zoos, at least some zoos, position themselves that way very intentionally, that they're actually pro-wilderness, pro-conservation. They talk about zoos as being educational places for children specifically. How do you respond to that sort of discourse?
Well, for a very, very small number of zoos, there is a legitimate conservation component, and usually when I talk about that, people interpret that to mean captive breeding and returning animals to the wild. That has been done, but it's so overblown by the zoo community generally that it's ridiculous. I think there's been in the neighborhood of 10 or 11 species that have been introduced back into the wild from partially zoo-based programs where self-sustaining populations have been generated. But if you compare those 8 or 10 or 12 species to the 10,000 zoos in the world and the billions of dollars that are spent every year and the millions of person hours that are involved, it's a pretty dismal return on investment. It'd be make a lot more sense to just put whatever monies that zoos are using into real conservation in the wild. In terms of education, there's no proof that looking at animals in cages has any educational value whatsoever. There's no data on that, and I always challenge the zoo industry to produce it, because I would think that if there really was an educational value with 10,000 zoos in the world constantly having to defend themselves, that they'd produce all kinds of proof, but to date none exists. So on both counts, they're on pretty weak ground.
In terms of animals coming from wild places or even ones who've been bred in captivity, what are some of the psychological and physical effects that they experience there? I imagine, especially if you're, you know, a giraffe that's coming from a place where you have quite a large range, for example, and then going to a more confined place, that this would have a pretty severe psychological impact. What's your knowledge of how animals are affected by living in zoos?
Well, it has all kinds of impacts, and like you said, it has impacts whether you're captive-born or wild-born, because the captive-born animals are still wild animals. They still have all the inherent drives and instincts that their wild counterparts do. So if you're a lion that's born in captivity, you still want to do things that lions do. And if you're a lion that's captured from the wild, you still want to do things, obviously, that wild lions do. I think it's just a question of degree in what they experience, but certainly they experience the same thing. So certainly many animals experience frustration because they want to do things, and in the captive environment, they're just not able to do those things. So it can be migration, it can be hunting, it can be patrolling a territory, it can be living within a proper social context, it can be simply having the ability to choose what they do at any point in time. So there's all kinds of activities that are natural to animals that are frustrated. And along with that frustration comes boredom, deprivation, and many other things. And all of these ultimately lead to the suffering of the animal, because if they're chronic and they occur over time, they are definitely going to result in suffering.
Do you suggest for people who maybe they're listening, they have families that they like to take out to the zoo, or they themselves like to go out to the zoo, do you suggest that people don't go to zoos, or that they write management and ask for improved conditions? What's your sort of primary goal in terms of the activism and the work that you do on zoos?
Well, I think mostly what we're trying to do is to give people the full picture, you know, disclose all of the information, because most people who visit zoos, they just assume, they take, you know, on faith that these are conservation-oriented institutions, that they are engaged in rehabilitation of wildlife, they are engaged in education, that they are good things. And I think what we're trying to do is say to people, look, there is another side to the story. We believe that if they know the other side of the story, that they will choose of their own accord not to visit or support these kinds of facilities, and if they do, to research them thoroughly and only go to ones like the Halliburton Wolf Center that actually do a decent job.
Okay, great. We'll probably wrap up our interview now. I just wanted to let people know that if you're interested in finding out more about ZooCheck or WSPA, you can log on to animalvoices.ca, and we have tons of links there, and links will direct you to the right places in terms of finding out more about this type of work. Thanks, Rob, for being on the program.
Well, thank you very much.
We were speaking with Rob Laidlaw. He's a director at ZooCheck Canada and a co-founder of that organization, as well as the project manager at WSPA. And now we're going to be speaking with Pat Tohill, and he's going to be speaking more specifically about Ontario roadside zoos. We got a little bit of REM there. That was great. So Pat, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us about Ontario roadside zoos. This is an issue that a lot of people are probably fairly unfamiliar with, especially urbanites such as myself, who spend probably far too much time in the city.
Sure. Well, WSPA has been conducting a campaign alongside our member organization, ZooCheck Canada, since before they were a member organization. ZooCheck approached us a number of years ago about the zoo issue, and we began partnering. We've released a series of reports looking at zoos in Canada, but primarily our main concern is what we call roadside zoos, which we would define as grossly substandard amateur facilities that lack appropriate safety practices, proper training for staff and management, and appropriate standards of animal care.
I'm even having a hard time picturing it. Like, are these zoos then just on the roads? I think I've been to one. Where are they usually by truck stops, or where are these places located, and who are they run by?
Well, it's sort of an outgrowth out of the fact that in Canada and in many municipalities, the keeping of exotic animals is still unregulated. It's been left pretty much to the municipalities to exclude certain classes of animals. So in most parts of Canada, if you want to own a lion or tiger, nobody's going to stop you from doing that unless there's a local municipal bylaw. There's very few provincial laws which put any kind of restrictions on the keeping of exotic wildlife. You can't in Alberta. You can't in Newfoundland and a few other provinces, but in Ontario, in Quebec, in many provinces, if it's not a native wildlife species, there might be restrictions on raccoons or bears and the keeping of native wildlife, but if it's an exotic species, you can pretty much start collecting animals. And there might be zoo permitting, which would come into effect if you wanted to open to the public as a zoo, but you can keep whatever animals you want.
Okay, so then the roadside zoos do have some sort of zoo permitting process that they go through? There's some kind of licensing that happens?
Most provinces have some sort of zoo licensing, although the standards are sort of all over the board. As far as zoos in Canada, the worst case is Ontario, where we have only limited laws which govern the keeping of native wildlife in captivity, but we have really no laws about the keeping of exotic wildlife. So you don't even need a zoo permit in the province of Ontario. I mean, a lot of people may think you do, but you actually don't. You can keep the animals in any conditions. You can keep them in as small a cage as you want. And as long as you're not being egregiously cruel to those animals, which would obviously bring the SPCA into the picture, as long as you're providing the very basic necessities of food and water and a shelter, you can pretty much treat the animals any way you want. You don't have to have any regard for public safety. You don't have to have any regard for whether or not there's appropriate educational efforts being put forward. And a lot of these places are really ramshackle, run-down, you know, tourist traps. We call them roadside zoos because a lot of them are off of a major highway or on a major highway. And they're set up as tourist traps. You know, there'll be advertisements in the local Chamber of Commerce tourism office. There'll be usually a sign out by the road directing people to the zoo. And, you know, just by word of mouth and by the signage, people will go to these zoos and pay their $5 and walk around. And we receive many complaints from people. You don't have to be a genius to figure out that a lot of these places are really rough and that this is not an appropriate way to keep animals. But right now there's not much that can be done about it.
So the people that are running these zoos, they're in sort of those peripheral areas, at least peripheral to the city. Are they sort of people who are just, are they impoverished people? Are they people that are just looking to for some extra income? Have you had any dialogue directly with the owners of the
facilities? Oh, yeah. I've met some roadside zoo operators, and all of them would maintain that they're not a roadside zoo by our definition.
Right.
And, you know, nobody's going to say, well, yeah, I'm a substandard zoo. Most of them think they're doing nothing wrong. Most of them have their defenders, and most of them feel that they love their animals. And I'm sure that they think they do. You know, it's a little like the lady with 100 cats, whose cats are cannibalizing each other, and they're all mangy and flea-ridden and full of diseases. And, you know, the neighbors all say they're shocked when the SPCA moves in. You know, she loved her cats. She would feed her cats before she would feed herself. And it's a little bit of the same thing. You know, a lot of these roadside zoos actually call themselves sanctuaries. You know, and we'll say that we're a sanctuary. We actually have taken in most of these animals that were abandoned pets or they were from bad zoos, because, of course, they are not a bad zoo. It's the other zoos that are the bad zoos. And it's true that in many cases they may have a number of animals, but you're not a true sanctuary if you're breeding animals, and a lot of these roadside zoos are breeding.
And what type of animals?
Trade.
You said exotics were sort of exotic.
Lions, tigers, macaws, monkeys, Kawate Mundi, what else? Various types of deer. These are all quite common animals in roadside zoos.
And you mentioned that there would be
llamas.
Sorry, yeah, there would be some minimum standards met, or the humane societies would be out there. But you're obviously arguing that the basics, however they are defined, are not enough. So
well,
what are the conditions that you're concerned about?
Well, the thing to remember is that the SPCA Act in Ontario is punitive in nature, as are most provincial SPCA Acts. And in the province of Quebec, they don't even yet have a provincial Animal Welfare Act of any kind. So in a case where animals are being neglected or somebody's abusing an animal, the SPCA can move in if they can prove that the animals were being willfully and intentionally abused. So often the burden of proof on the SPCA is very high. And a lot of the inspectors who work for provincial humane societies aren't well versed in what are the needs of a lion or a llama or an emu. They may well know what is appropriate or inappropriate in terms of keeping a dog in your backyard, and can step in and take corrective action or lay charges if somebody is not providing the necessities for a dog, but they may not know what's appropriate for an exotic animal. Furthermore, as I said, the burden of proof is really high, and so it's up to the SPCA to convince a judge that lions need a larger area than like a 15 by 30 cage, which is quite common in roadside zoos. You often see a 15 foot by 30 foot cage for a lion or a tiger, and it might be hard to convince them that those animals need some sort of enrichment to occupy their time so that they're not just pacing endlessly from one side of the cage to another. The tiger, you know, spends large amounts of time in the wild, in a pool or in a stream swimming, and therefore should be provided with some sort of pool to swim in or to bathe in. And, you know, that concrete is an inappropriate surface for a number of reasons. You know, it's hard on the pads of the feet. It's not an appropriate substrate for most animals. These are really tough issues. So what we really need is legislation for zoos that is specific to zoos that lays out the standards for keeping animals in captivity. And we do have that in some provinces. Also, in Ontario, we have standards that are before the minister waiting for approval. They've been waiting for about 4 years now for native wildlife in captivity. So there will be some sort of minimum standards for keeping of raccoons, keeping of various native species of deer, keeping of bears, but it's not going to apply to exotic wildlife.
Pat, we'll have to end the interview there. I'll direct people again to our website, animalvoices.ca, and there's links there to get to the WSPA site, which will take you to all the relevant information. You can find out more about roadside zoos there. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Pat Tohill is the campaigns manager for WSPA, World Society for the Protection of Animals, and we reached him in Toronto. We are now going to head over to New York and speak with Lawrence Carter-Long, who is the issue specialist at In Defense of Animals, and we're going to speak with him about World Week for Animals and Laboratories, which is beginning April 23rd. And we're going to find out more about vivisection and why they're doing a whole week to try to raise awareness about animals in labs. So hopefully we have Lawrence on the line right now. We'll bring him on and we'll find out more about vivisection, which is which means animal experimentation. Well, it's experimentation on live animals. Thanks, Lawrence, for being on the program.
Thank you.
So tell us about World Week for Animals and Laboratories.
Yeah, World Week for Animals and Laboratories was basically started in the early 1980s. And what we did at In Defense of Animals took a day of action, what had been a day of action, and expanded that to a week of action. This year it'll be held between April 23rd and April 30th to really increase the notoriety or the infamous nature of animal experimentation across the world. So it's an opportunity for people to learn about what's happening with animals, both in their own backyard and on an international level.
And so what is happening with animals?
Well, if you really look, you know, animals are being gassed, they're being burned, they're being electrocuted, and it's all done basically to give people the illusion of safety. What are we told? The reasons for animal experimentation are, well, we want to help sick people, right? And so folks are basically taught to short-circuit their brains and have an emotional appeal. Oh, my gosh, well, of course we want that. So I guess it's necessary. And the assumptions that keep animal experimentation going are really the most dangerous things when it comes to human health.
You had mentioned on the phone to me yesterday that you come from kind of an unusual perspective, and you talked about your shtick in relationship to people, sort of the primary argument often in terms of animal experimentation for biomedical experimentation is that if you knew someone that was sick or had some kind of, you know, major disease or some kind of disability, that you would want everything to be done, including killing lots of animals, in order to help that person out. And who are you to say that we shouldn't be doing animal experimentation if you're an able-bodied person, et cetera, et cetera. Can you tell us about some of the work that you've done in terms of challenging some of those myths?
Sure. I was a poster child for a fundraising charity with United Cerebral Palsy. I have cerebral palsy, which is a neuromuscular condition. It's caused by damage to the part of the brain that tells the muscles how to work, basically. It affects everyone who has it differently. I was born 3 months premature, weighed 2 pounds, 12 ounces, dropped down to 1 1/4. In fact, stopped breathing a number of times. And we were told a bunch of nonsense after I was born, you know, that I would never walk, need special education, so on and so forth. And what happens when one is a poster child? You're basically carted out, and people say, well, ooh, don't you want to help this child? They'll give us some money. Same is done with animal experimentation. If you challenge what's being done to animals, they'll say, don't you want to help sick people? You're not taught to think about it. You're taught to have that emotional appeal. But if you know the history of animal experimentation, it's not quite that clear. I'll give you an example. Researchers from Harvard and Boston universities looked at the medical measures that accounted for the total decline in mortality rates since 1900. Now, we're talking scores of animals were killed in the quest to find cures for tuberculosis, scarlet fever, smallpox, diphtheria, you name it. But what was their unwilling contribution? Was it important to the decline of these diseases? Well, these researchers at Harvard and Boston University, themselves no animal rights activists, found that they only accounted for between 1 and 3.5% of the total decline in mortality rate since 1900. The head researcher said that the primary credit for the virtual eradication of these diseases must go to improvements in human health, sanitation, and a general improvement in the standard of living. Obviously, these things have nothing to do with animal experimentation, and what animal research does is it appropriates time and money and personnel and facilities and other resources that would save far more lives if those resources were placed into things like education or prevention. So what we're trying to do is get people to think about animal experimentation a little bit differently and say, where do you want to see the money go? Do you want to see it to go directly to people that need the assistance, or do you want to keep carving up rats and mice?
You're pretty heavily involved in the disability rights movement as well. How have people responded to your perspective on animal experimentation?
Well, generally speaking, I think they're shocked at first because of the reasons that I've mentioned. The assumptions are that you'd want it to be done, but
I remember I was doing a radio program with sort of a more conservative talk show host a number of years ago, and he said, "Now, Carter Long, if you could have a cure for cerebral palsy as a result of animal studies, now wouldn't you take it? Tell us the truth." And my response to him was, "What would I have to give up?"
Mm-hmm.
Because those animals didn't do anything to me. And what do I lose as a human being, right? By allowing an experiment to be done on an animal that did not ask to be there. The main problem, we can talk about science all we want, but the main problem with animal studies is that no rat, no mouse, no cat, no dog, no monkey ever hopped up at the entry counter to a experimentation lab or a university and said, "Oh, you're doing research on cancer or on heart disease? Excuse me." They can't sign a consent form. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they can't sign a consent form says that we must do it differently, and that we must find better ways to do it. And so people, I think, are shocked at first, but when they think about the issue a little bit differently, when they're taught to really address the questions and the problems with animal studies, when they learn more about it, they're right in line with what I have to say.
I think that so many people, in terms of vegetarianism and issues around animal testing, they might sort of be half on board, but, you know, when you start talking about rats or mice, they think, well, it's just a mouse, you know, it's just a rat. You know, we're talking about human beings here that are, you know, suffering and having a great deal of not only physical but psychological trauma. Really, why are you getting so upset about just a rat?
Yeah, and all animals, you know, deserve consideration. I mean, if you look at the testing policies within the United States, about 80 to 85% of the animals that are used, and the estimates really range anywhere from between 20 million and 70 million animals. So 85% of those are rats and mice. So if you really want to address the greatest number of animals used, you've got to really look at what's happening to rats and mice, and they deserve our consideration as well. Is anybody going to say, with even a rudimentary knowledge of biology, that rats don't feel stress, that they don't feel pain? Clearly not. And so they deserve consideration as well.
Are most of the experiments being done right now for cancer? You had mentioned cancer, that the mouse wouldn't be hopping up to the table saying, "Use me." Or, you know, there's you hear about pain experiments and experiments around sleep deprivation and alcoholism, and not that alcoholism isn't also important, but what are the most of experiments being sort of directed towards at this point?
Well, what happens is that we're told that there's safety involved. Let's look at drug testing, for example. In the States, the Journal of the American Medical Association has reported that 100,000 people die each year after taking drugs that have all passed a battery of animal tests. And so what happens is people think that the drugs have gone through animal testing, and so therefore they're safe. Clearly not the case. When's the last time you went to a veterinarian when you got sick? Never, obviously.
I'm looking over at Rob. Rob, over to you.
Rob, have you gone to veterinarians when you're ill?
I have to say no.
Okay.
That wouldn't be my first
and
choice.
Most people would probably have the same answer. And so we shouldn't rely on animal studies either. And so what it provides is an illusion of safety. People think that they're safe. And then what do you tell someone who's lost a mother, a brother, a cousin, a loved one, due to relying on animal tests? Oops, we tried it on a rat. That's not good enough. And when it comes down to human health, when we're doing animal tests for the hypothetical benefit of humans, really, it is a life and death matter.
We had just had a couple of people on talking about zoos, and I think, again, a lot of people probably listening think, well, there's some standards in place. Like, we do care about animals in Canada or North America or whatever comes to mind, and there must be some standards. Aren't there animal welfare standards in place to make sure that there isn't sort of egregious cruelty happening, or that they're not being traumatized so much?
Well, let's look at the government statistics. Let's address Canada for a moment. The Canadian Council on Animal Care says that nearly two-thirds of all the animal research carried out in Canada has little or nothing to do with curing disease or advancing human health. Now, you've got more than 1 million animals each year in Canada that are being killed in what can best be described as curiosity-driven research. So really what happens is you've got a situation, particularly within university environments, where people are driven to either publish or perish. If you don't get a paper published in a medical journal, if you don't get your university recognized, you're out of a job. And it's particularly easy, both in the United States and in Canada, for anyone to do this, because you can take an animal model, let's say you've been working on rats for a number of years, and change a small variable. Instead of using male rats, you'll use female rats. And do basically the same study and then try to get it published. Whether or not it means anything to you or I is another story, but what it is it's a self-perpetuating system that keeps itself going. And if you look at the groups that often push and promote an agenda to keep the industry alive, that are really behind the scenes in promoting animal experimentation and vivisection, you've got people that make the cages, sell the cages, mm-hmm. breed the animals, make the food, sell the food. Now, why would they want to see 1 million animals in Canada or up to 70 million in the United States die each year? Clearly, there's a financial benefit to them as a result of it.
There's a lot of secrecy around animal experimentation, and I think that the industry generally says, well, you know, it's scientific work, and we don't want to necessarily swap our research with somebody else. There's a lot of competition involved as well. But I think that secrecy also is a great way of keeping the animal rights activists' noses out of their business. How are you finding out about what's actually going on in the labs?
Well, it's particularly hard there. In the United States, there used to be something called the Freedom of Information Act that we were able to use really to get information from government laboratories and to investigate what's being done, how many animals are being done, or what type of experimentation is being done on them. It's getting increasingly hard to get that information out because of laws that have been passed and because of the clout and the real power that the agencies have and that the governmental agencies have for maintaining their secrecy. So it's getting harder and harder. We're finding more and more, though, when the most devastating news comes out, it's because of people of conscience, people on the inside of a laboratory that sees what's going on, and they can't put up with it anymore. So they either leak information or find a way to get information to organizations like ours so that somebody can take corrective action.
I know animal and rights activists are always accused of being so biased, and science likes to prop itself up as being quite objective. I imagine it's a kind of an upwards battle in terms of public consciousness raising.
I think that so-called objectivity is a messaging tactic that they use. They want to say that they're scientific and that they're, you know, really looking for details or things that can help people. But what is that? You back that up with the information that came out of, let's say, the study that I mentioned from Boston and Harvard, and you find that it's not the case. So it's actually, to my mind, they're the ones who use the emotional arguments and try to prevent people from finding out what's really going on inside the lab.
Lawrence, tell us about some of the recent cases, some of the information that's been brought to you from inside the labs that people have been, as you said, they just can't put up with it anymore.
Well, I think probably one of the most notable cases was here in the United States. Just a few years ago, there was the Colston Foundation that had the largest number of chimpanzees within the United States and within research that was closed down due to people leaking information from the inside, which we were able to provide to government. And after an eight-year campaign, actually got that laboratory shut down and some of those chimpanzees released to sanctuaries in places like Florida.
And what about some other cases that have come to light?
Well, if anybody wants more information on the type of experiments that are being done, I think probably what you can do is go to the In Defense of Animals website, which is IDAUSA.org, or WWAIL.org, which stands for World Week for Animals in Laboratories. And they can really find out all the details for the particular studies that have been going on and what we've been working on as well.
One of the most difficult things I find with doing a radio program is a lot of the topics that we talk about are quite gruesome. I mean, animal cruelty is, by definition, quite bad. And that these terms like vivisection, you know, they're so sort of sanitized and clean, you know, or even to talk about factory farming, it really doesn't mean a lot to people. So I'm always sort of curious when I'm talking with someone who's so heavily involved with a particular issue, such as vivisection, which I imagine is quite traumatizing to look at over and over again, sort of how to give people a picture of what actually goes on there that can make it real for people.
It's very difficult because you don't necessarily want to, there's some utility, I think, to the videos and to the images and the pictures because you can't deny what's happening when you see that. But, of course, I think the trauma is very hard for activists and for people as they grow to find out more about the type of studies that are going on. The most important thing, though, I think, for folks doing radio programs like yours or for activists who are getting more and more interested in the issue is realize that you're not part of the problem. You know, you've got two options. You can either make yourself aware and decide to do something about it. And there is a lot of strength that comes from saying, I'm going to take a stand here, I'm going to make an effort, and I'm going to see that things change. And that's what we really need to look for. Instead of focusing on what's difficult to look at or what's really hard to see, you can make yourself aware of these things, but also take a lot of consolation in the fact that you're working to solve the problem and that you're not a part of it.
I think that's a wonderful note to end on. Lawrence, thanks so much for being on the program. I wanted to direct people to your personal website as well as to the In Defense of Animal website. You're at posterbrat.com, and then there's links to IDA, In Defense of Animals, on our website, animalvoices.ca. Thanks, Lawrence, for being on the program.
Sure, and if people want more information, they can just email us at IDA@IDAUSA.org. We'll be glad to help you out.
There's lots of information there about World Week for Animals and Labs, and you can figure out where you want to put your efforts in terms of raising awareness about this issue, and there's all that information on the IDA website. So, again, the World Week for Animals and Labs starts on April 23rd, and we were speaking with Lawrence Carter Long. He's the issue specialist at In Defense of Animals. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have any questions or comments for us at Animal Voices, write us at animalvoices, that's all one word, at CIUT.FM. And then there's our archive programs as well. If you hear something and you want more information, or if you sort of came in halfway through a show, you can always catch it on our archives at animalvoices.ca. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore co-hosting, and Lamia teching with us today. I wanted to take just a few minutes and read some of the responses that we got to a call-out that I did for people in the animal rights and vegan vegetarian communities in response to an article called Trust and Tofu, which was kind of a funny article that was in the recent Globe and Mail in Toronto. I'm not sure if that's national,
yep,
nationwide.
It is national.
So this woman did a veggie challenge. Her name is Jacqueline Francis, and she took the veggie challenge, and she became vegan for a week, and she got some headaches, and she ate lentils. When I read that she was eating lentils for, I think it was one of her first meals, I was like, oh no, what are you doing?
I still haven't eaten lentils, actually.
Yeah, you know, like, it's always the lentils. And so anyway, and she makes a tofu loaf, and it's actually pretty good, but she keeps waking up with headaches. And so I there's a great website called veganporn.com, and it's not a porn site, but it's a great place for people to come together and sort of swap ideas and read a bunch of really hilarious and often quite disturbing news about animals by Herman Thrust, who is the person who runs the website. That's a pseudonym. And so anyway, we asked people for what you would do, what would you suggest to peeps, to somebody who was considering going vegan for a week. What advice would you give? So here's some of the responses that we got. I'll let Rob kick it off.
The first one says, our advice to someone who wants to go vegan is to check out a local restaurant that is veg. There are many great ones in Toronto. That way you can sample some of the things that you might like to then try at home. Sometimes seitan, tempeh, tofu, and even vegetables can look daunting when you see them in a grocery store. If you try some vegan food that is made for you by someone who knows what they're doing, then you'll have a good positive first experience with eating veg, and you'll be motivated to create food at home that is equally delicious. After eating such good food for a week, surely you'll want to stay a little longer on the vegan train.
There's another one here that says, as for your query, it has already been answered well, but my addition would be very simple. I would like to emphasize that any change in diet or behavior is going to have ramifications on a person's well-being and take some getting used to. Not all changes that come are going to be a result of the diet itself. Some will be nothing more than the body adjusting, so patience would be my recommendation. Allow the body to come to terms with a new way of being before judging it. This applies to more than going vegan anyway.
Yeah, patience is good.
Yeah.
Be patient. Another one says, I'm with you on the tofuti cutie thing. Lauren mentioned that she'd hand somebody a tofuti cutie if they were going to go.
Like ice cream sandwiches for vegans.
And they're awesome.
Or for anybody.
I love the chocolate ones. Somebody should have told her to start out with more fruit, soy milk, and whole grains instead of lentils. You could also point out the effects of detox so she might know what she was experiencing.
That's also a really good one as well. There's another one here that mentions, she says, in addition to what everyone else has said, I would recommend taking things slow. This goes back to the patience, so not beating yourself up for mistakes. There's a lot of things that I know that I didn't know when I first went vegan, and I found myself kicking my own ass, even though I only made mistakes because I didn't know any better. Beating yourself up over things that you can really not control will only make the transition harder.
It's true, yeah. It's not really the veggie challenge. I don't think it's a challenge about purity. It's about a challenge about trying to just kind of change your lifestyle around this and try to adapt it more into your life. Anyway, another one says use resources such as GoVeg.com and one or more good vegan cookbooks. Find a buddy. Any big town will have a veg society, but you can also find buddies right here. And that's really good. In a few weeks, we're going to have someone who hosts or who sets up international vegan buddies, so you can do it with somebody else. Because it's difficult when you're not in a group or a community where nobody else is veg. I don't know how I would do it if I wasn't. Make sure you're getting enough calories. Give it more than a week. It's probably not veganism, but a particular mix of foods or bad luck that's causing headaches. And eat foods you're used to. For example, peanut butter, spaghetti with marinara sauce. And he also says, most diets require a little adjustment period. Don't give up. Many of us have been doing it for years. I reiterate point two. Come on over for support and encouragement.
There's a couple more that I wanted to get to, but we have Paul Watson on the line.
Excellent.
I believe. So I'd like to hopefully tack on a couple of letters right at the end, but I wanted to make sure that we got a chance to speak with Paul because we were not able to get through to him last week. Paul, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thank you.
It's a real honor to have you on the show. I've read so much about you over the years. So where are you located right now? What are your coordinates?
Well, actually, we're just on our way back to Bermuda right now. We're about 500 miles north of Bermuda in some pretty heavy weather.
So tell us about your experience this year with the seal hunt. What did you observe?
Well, we spent 2 months out there, first going into the Gulf of St. Lawrence in early March, and then moving over to the Labrador front. We were there in the Gulf when the seal hunt began. We were informed that we were in violation of the law for being in the area without permission of the Minister of Fisheries to film or document or photograph the hunt, which is illegal. We argued that it was our constitutional right to be there. As a result, 11 of my crew members were arrested and will appear in court, and we're going to use that as a forum to challenge the constitutionality of these regulations.
And were they arrested and then brought somewhere, or were they allowed to stay?
They're arrested on the ice, and then they were flown by helicopter to Charlottetown and jailed overnight. And then released the next day, and then we had to charter a helicopter to get them back. They refused to bring them back to the ship. The crew that are arrested, some of them were assaulted on the ice the day before by sealers who violently attacked my crew members, hitting one of them in the head with a hackapick. And none of those guys were arrested, even though the assault was completely documented from three different angles on three different cameras. So it's interesting that people go to jail for taking pictures, but people who assault other people with clubs aren't even charged.
Was any of that documented?
It was all fully documented, and it's actually been shown on national television across Canada. I think it was shown in Global. It's been shown internationally.
Right.
So but the Canadian government's just chosen to ignore it. In Canada, there's a law for sealers, and there's a law for everybody else.
Mm-hmm. So how did these interactions end up happening? People, can you give us sort of a picture of a day out on the ice, what that looks like?
Well, what we were simply trying to do was to capture violations, of which there are plenty of them, cruelty against the seals. The Canadian government says 100% of the seals that are killed humanely, which is ridiculous. Every time we go out there, we observe cruelty. I saw this year one sealer go up and kick a seal pup in the face and then skin it while it was still alive. Bob Talbot, the world-famous wildlife photographer, was out on the ice, and he saw a seal that had been skinned was crawling across the ice without its pelt. So there's numerous violations. This is why these regulations are there, to prevent people from seeing the truth, and it's a censorship law. That's all it is. It's amazing. It's called the seal protection regulations. No protection for seals, of course.
There's so much bad press about, lots of good press, but lots of bad press about the sea shepherd instigating violence and the animal rights activists, although I don't know if you position yourself that way, but that the animal people are the ones who are really the ones instigating this violence. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's ridiculous. We don't have weapons. We didn't assault anybody. Our crew were armed with cameras when they were attacked. And, in fact, none of my crew made any attempt to defend themselves because I told them not to do that. They had to take those blows without defending themselves. I mean, that's typical of the Canadian government and the Canadian media to make these attacks. I did a debate with Natural Resources Minister John Efford, and he just came out with all of his propaganda in the debate. He said, you know, you people are nothing but hypocrites doing this to raise money while you're dining on veal and lamb on board your ship. Well, you know, this is their propaganda. We're a completely vegan vessel, and there's no meat or fish served on our ship. But they keep saying these lies over and over again, so the public will begin to believe them.
Yeah, and I think that groups like the Sea Shepherd, we've had We had Rebecca Aldworth on the program a number of times. People often see this as being about being pro or anti-labor, that if you're against the seal hunt, you must be wanting people, you know, in Newfoundland, fishermen in Newfoundland, to starve.
Well, there's no starving fishermen in Newfoundland, and if eventually they do starve, it'll be because of their own greed and having wiped out all the resources. They've destroyed the fishery thanks to the incompetence and mismanagement of the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and the greed of the drag trawlers is what wiped out the fish, and they're in the process of wiping out what remains. So, yes, there may be starvation in Newfoundland, and it may happen in the future, but it will be the fault of the people who are just taking too much.
What do you think the next step is? I mean, you've been observing the seal hunt now for a number of years. Are you seeing it getting any better or any worse? And where would you like to see the activism go in the future?
Well, we shut it down back in 1984, but all of our victories are always temporary, so we've got to start it all over again. So we're trying to build up the momentum that we had in the late 70s and early 80s. And I think that this year contributed greatly. We got a lot of publicity worldwide directed towards this campaign. But the real weapon is the boycott, which we're working with the Humane Society of the United States, which is to boycott Canadian seafood products, which is a little strange. You know, it's hard for vegetarian groups to boycott seafood products, but at least we're encouraging that because it's a $2.5 billion a year industry, and the seal hunt is worth $16 million. So if we convince enough seafood distributors to not purchase Canadian seafood, we just have to get them to go over that $16 million to make the seal hunt a total loss. And so that's what we're working at. It's the one thing they're really afraid of. Sea Shepherd's also promoting a boycott of tourism to Canada, too, any kind of economic pressure, because it's the only language that the government and businesses understand is profit and loss. So we have to make this a non-profitable venture for them.
Do you think people are listening? Do you feel like this year's documentation and the activism that you were part of was a success?
Oh, yeah. I've been doing hundreds of interviews from around the world, to New Zealand and Turkey, all over. So people are interested. We had people demonstrating in front of Canadian consulates and embassies on March 15th in over 40 countries. Already there's Legal Seafoods, which is a restaurant chain on the east coast of the U.S., has announced that they're not going to purchase any Canadian seafood, and we're working on other groups and distributors and restaurants like that. We're also going to be distributing a thing called a seal of approval to go on restaurants who agree not to serve Canadian seafood products. And so I think this is something they're going to have to listen to. When the Minister of Fisheries of Newfoundland gets on the radio and spends 5 minutes telling everybody how he's not worried about the boycott of Canadian seafood, that means to me that he's very worried about the boycott.
Right. Have you had any luck with dialoguing with sealers directly about the boycotts? Are any of them listening or taking note or, you know, wanting to build any kind of coalitions?
No, and we don't attempt to. If other groups want to try and talk to these guys, as far as I'm concerned, anybody who participates in the seal hunt is a barbarian practicing an inhumane trade. I have no respect for them, no sympathy for them. The horror, the cruelty that I've seen out on that ice for the last 30 years has certainly driven any compassion that I have for the people who kill the seals completely away. My compassion is 100% with the seals. I don't really care what people think about that. I've just seen too much suffering and too much death out there to be concerned about the, you know, the interests of the people who are killing them.
Do you think that we'll see the end of the seal hunt in the next few years?
All we can do is hope. We're going to certainly put all of our effort in that. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not just the seals. The oceans are being diminished severely because all of the motivation is in the profit that we made from destroying life in the sea, and there's very little motivation to protect life in the sea. So all over the world's fisheries are collapsing. Poachers are moving into national parks. The oceans are under assault. So it's not just seals, it's also whales and dolphins, fish, seabirds, and turtles. They're all under assault. And if we destroy them, we destroy ourselves. So really, our campaign is not just to protect the seals and the whales and the dolphins. It's actually a campaign for self-preservation, because in our ignorance, we can destroy life in the ocean and therefore destroy our own way of life.
Paul, as you're leaving the 2005 seal hunt now, what are some of your feelings and your thoughts about the hunt?
Well, this is the largest slaughter of marine wildlife anywhere in the world. These are the largest number of seals that have been killed in over a century. The government has got a plan, as far as I'm concerned, of extermination, that they want to wipe out these seals. They're trying to scapegoat them for the decline of the cod. The scientific information on this shows just the opposite. If you want more cod, you need more seals, because the biggest predator of codfish, aside from humans, are other fish, the very fish that harp seals prey upon. So when you lower harp seal populations, you you actually diminish cost populations even further. You know, the Canadian government sees this as just three factors, fish, seals, and people. When just a simplified look at the food chain in the eastern, the northeastern Atlantic will show you that there's over 950 species interacting with each other. It's a very complex system, and we've just got to stop playing God, and the Canadian government has already proven itself to be incapable of managing anything.
For the average listener who is who's tuning into this program, they might be thinking, well, you know, I'm not the government. I didn't sanction that hunt. What kind of personal responsibility do you think Canadians in particular need to take, or where do you think people should put their efforts now if they're listening to this program and they want to add their voice to this movement?
Well, one of the problems is that the political parties in Canada all support this because they don't think people will vote for them when they're on this. And I just say people should contact their members of parliament and say, if you don't come out against the seal hunt, you're not getting my vote, no matter what your party is. The politicians have got to realize that this is something that people are concerned about. When I see the polls in British Columbia show that, for instance, 78% of BC residents are against the seal hunt, yet every single member of parliament for British Columbia supports it, something's very wrong there. The will of the people is not being reflected in their elected representatives. There's no reason for this to continue. It's giving a bloody stain on Canada's image worldwide. And, you know, all over the world, people think, oh, bloody Canada, the place where they kill baby seals. And, you know, that's another lie, too. The government constantly says these aren't baby seals, that they're killing adult seals. Every single seal we saw killed out there this year was less than 7 weeks old. Now, the government defines an adult as anything over 3 weeks old. You know, anybody would call a seven-week-old seal that can't swim, that can't escape from its attacker, call that an adult, you know, that's just a serious distortion of the meaning of the word.
Paul, I'm doing my PhD right now, and I'm focusing on slaughterhouses, and I've been doing some historical research and looking at the different kill methods that have been used in slaughterhouses, and one of the outmoded methods for killing animals that we no longer see in Canadian slaughterhouses and U.S. slaughterhouses is whacking an animal over the head with an object like a hammer to stun them, supposedly. And so it's interesting that in slaughterhouses, ideally, they're using different stun methods, but out on the ice, those methods still stand.
Well, the other interesting thing is the Minister of Natural Resources, John Efford, said, you know, these people out there protecting seals, but they don't care about animals that are being killed in slaughterhouses. And they just make these generalizations.
Yeah.
The fact is that we do care, and that's one of the reasons we're a vegetarian vessel. But the other thing, too, is that the government says, well, the seals are killed more humanely than in slaughterhouses. Well, that's absolutely not true. I don't think that any slaughterhouse would allow, or at least get away with, if it was exposed, if a calf or a pig were being skinned alive on the abattoir floor. And that is the kind of stuff that is going out on the ice off of eastern Canada everywhere.
Yeah, unfortunately, it does happen far too often. Gail Eisen's book, Slaughterhouse, revealed that upwards of, you know, 10% of animals are being skinned alive on the line. But yes, of course, it's not supposed to be happening. Paul, thanks for being on the program. It was great to speak with you today.
Well, thank you.
And good luck on the rest of your trip. I wish that the weather is treats you well and your crew well.
Thanks
so much. We were speaking with Paul Watson. He is the captain of the Farley Mowat. They are just in the process of leaving the seal hunt now. He is also a co-founder of Greenpeace. Very big name. Great to have him on the program. We're out of time, so we're not going to get a chance to read through the rest of the letters, but maybe we'll get a chance at another point to share some of our listener feedback, which would be great. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Again, we were just speaking with Paul Watson. You can find out more about any of the guests that we had on or any of the topics that we discussed today on our website, animalvoices.ca. Thanks, Rob, for coming in. I know that I did most of the talking, most of the interviewing today. Thanks also to Lamia for teching today. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner CIUT 89.5.